The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is gsuggsinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine, as usual, features the red border on the front cover with a narrow white marginal inner border. At the top right-hand corner, where one would turn the page, presumably, our 100th year is written. Time is in white and large block print capital letters. The date is July 3, 2023. The cover photo is of a young man dressed all in black except gray boots. He's seated on a black chair. The background appears to be panels of beige, green, beige, and green, over which time is superimposed. The 100 most influential companies are featured in this edition, some of which I plan to read. And the portrait of the young man is OpenAI CEO Sam Altman. Beginning with climate, confronting wildfire smoke and its meaning. The cause of the haze was simple enough. As hundreds of wildfires burned in central Canada in early June, exacerbated by dry conditions and warm temperatures, cities across the eastern U.S. saw thick smog and record air pollution as minute particles hopped a ride on a breeze traveling north to south. All the smoke gets deposited up in the air, gets caught in the wind flow and pushed out into the states, says Tom Kynes, a senior meteorologist at AccuWeather. These fires are still burning up there. They're still putting smoke into the sky. And as long as you have a source of smoke, it is going to be an issue. But if the science was simple, the scale was staggering. Over 200 out-of-control blazes, New York City registering its worst air quality readings in recorded history. In a place unaccustomed to wildfires, the emotional impact was as unsettling as the sore throats that had people digging out N95 masks from the long slog of COVID-19. This time the hazard was something you could see, and a reminder of what a warming world brings. The urgency was as close as the air we breathe. That column was written by Anisha Coli. There are two photos here, which take up about two-thirds of the page, and they're in color, except it's a very muted, hazy color. One of them shows a bright orange sky. Well, really not bright, more of a dull, hazy orange sky with the sun in a haze above the horizon. The sun is white with a yellow corona. Right below the sun is a Ferris wheel with some structures. In front of the Ferris wheel, a couple of pillars are included. And in front of the pillars is orangey-looking water reflecting that yellow-coronated sun. And that depicts Chicago's Navy Pier, June 8. And then there's another photo here of a horse. It's the silhouette of a horse in the foreground in the center. Off to the left is a partial silhouette of a man standing and holding the horse's lead. In the background, there is another hazy sky. This one isn't so orange. It has orange tints going from right to left that turn into a lighter peach that turn into a gray, with the sun again above the horizon, and this time it's in a orange aura with really a rather bright looking whitish sun. Well, the character in the foreground in the center is a horse being bathed in Elmont, New York, June 8, days before the June 10 Belmont Stakes. Training was paused. Captive audience, this is Beneath the World heading. On land rushes held for most of a decade, the final battle will be for Hearts and Minds by Simon Schuster. This is a two-page photo spread here in color, but the colors are rather dull and muted. Brick walls, rather primitive looking. There's a window off to one side that looks like there's really no window. It looks like a hole in the wall. It might be a basement or cellar, but it might not. The flooring, the ground is all broken up. It looks like broken up concrete or perhaps just dilapidated stone. Three people are seated in this area on what look like rickety chairs, but maybe they're not. Some of them are wearing camouflage gear. Oh, there must be a fourth because I see another pair of feet. Some are wearing camouflage gear. One is wearing, these are all men apparently, one's wearing a denim jacket with camouflage pants. A couple are wearing caps. One's camouflage, one's not, and one looks like a knitted cap. And they're all looking, seemingly tuned in, to a TV set that's also on a rickety piece of furniture next to the brick wall. And the TV set has a photo of Vladimir Putin. One day, last fall, Volodymyr Zelensky, president of Ukraine, came across a clip from Russian TV that had gone viral on social media. It showed one of Russia's most prominent talk show hosts calling for Ukrainian children to be killed, thrown in a river with a strong current, for speaking out against the Russian occupation of their homeland. Even by the ugly standards of Russian warmongering, the statement seemed to cross a line, and the host soon lost his job over it. But it continued to trouble Zelensky. Their society accepts this, consumes it, he told me with evident disgust a few weeks later. They live in this paradigm. The Russian invasion of Ukraine was in its ninth month at that point, long enough to harden Zelensky to many of its horrors, the bombardment of Ukrainian cities, the kidnapping of Ukrainian children, the torture and killing of civilians, all of which the president addressed in our interviews with a defiant kind of stoicism. But the Kremlin's propaganda and the hold it seems to have over many of its viewers still got under the president's skin. It shocks me, he said, the force of this information, the information sickness. Not only in Russia, but also across the occupied regions of eastern and southern Ukraine, millions of people absorb the Kremlin line about Ukraine through Russian television. Its central message, like a genocidal fever dream mixed in among gardening shows and soap operas, depicts Ukraine's existence as a historical mistake. Its government a cabal of Satanists and neo-Nazis intent on Russia's destruction. Zelensky, as the main villain in these narratives, does not believe their lack of subtlety makes them any less effective, and he's made it his mission not only to free Ukrainian land from Russian occupation, but also to liberate Ukrainians from what he calls the Russian information space. Since early June, when Ukraine began its biggest counteroffensive of the war, the armed forces have sought to prove their ability to shatter Russia's defensive lines and regain territory. But Zelensky, who sees himself as more of a communicator than a military strategist, worries about the political challenges to come, especially the need to win trust and support among people living in occupied lands. To reach them, he plans to use the same weapon Russia has used to indoctrinate them. Ukraine needs to break through, Zelensky told me, with its channels of information as actively as possible. In regions occupied in early 2022, Russia's not been able to win much support. The residents of Kherson in the south showed mass resistance to the occupation, staging rallies and standing in the way of enemy tanks. The Russians did not win in Kherson because inside themselves, the people did not support Russia, Zelensky said. They held firm. In other regions, the picture looks more complicated. Crimea in the south and parts of the Donbas region in the east have been under Russian control for 9 years, ever since Russian President Vladimir Putin first sent his forces to occupy them. With enough weapons from the West, Zelensky believes the military can evict the Russians from these regions, but he's far less certain about what comes next. People in the Donbas, they've been brainwashed, he told me. All they have, every single day, is the Russian information space. Nothing else exists there. So there's no hope the people there see Russia as the real occupier, he said. I can't reach them. He still intends to try, even if his struggle with Russia in the field of propaganda comes with serious risks, threatening to undermine the very freedoms Ukraine is fighting to defend. Zelensky has already faced criticism over wartime censorship and the government's plans to reintegrate Crimea and parts of the Donbas include tough methods, among them the forced expulsion of Russian civilians and what one Ukrainian general calls carrots and sticks. The president, a former producer and star of Ukrainian sitcoms, sees television as his weapon of choice for winning over people in the occupied territories. I need to be able to speak with them all the time, he says, assuming they are still ready to listen. I'm returning to that double-page spread of the photograph. I did not read the caption. The photograph in that barren brick-walled room depicts Ukrainian pilots watching Russia's Vladimir Putin at a Crimean air base, March 21, 2024. The photograph is by Viktor Drashev. Returning now to the text, the battle for the airwaves has played out in Ukraine for nearly a decade, always in parallel to the clashes at the front. In eastern Ukraine, one of Russia's first conquests took place April 17, 2014, when a group of heavily armed militants drove up to a TV tower on Karachun Hill. At the gates, they encountered two guards, a man and an elderly woman, along with a shaggy mutt named Bim that looked too small for his doghouse. When I interviewed the guards a few days later, they told me the gunmen went straight up to the tower's control room and asked the engineer to broadcast the frequency of Russia's main propaganda channel, Rossiya, R-O-S-S-I-Y-A. The engineer complied just in time to show Putin's annual call-in show, which lasted around 4 hours that day. Seated at a desk in front of a studio audience in Moscow, Putin used the show to expound on his imperialist vision for Ukraine. He referred to eastern and southern Ukraine as Novorussia, or New Russia, and he argued that with the fall of the Soviet Union in 1991, these lands unfairly ended up outside Moscow's control. God only knows why. From that point forward, Putin would use all means at his disposal, including military power, he said, to protect the ethnic Russians living in these regions from their own government, which he described as a bunch of radical nationalists. Coming a month after the Russian annexation of Crimea, Putin's performance served as a warning that he could do the same with other regions of Ukraine. The government in Kyiv, which had come to power in a revolution that winter, understood that Putin intended to use his TV networks to stir a separatist rebellion among ethnic Russians, and it tried to block access to these networks across the country. Throughout May 2014, the Ukrainian military fought fierce battles for Kherson Hill that ended only after its TV tower was destroyed. It made little difference. By the middle of summer, Russian forces took control of two major cities in eastern Ukraine, Donetsk and Luhansk, along with their television towers. "Let the people hear the truth," one of the separatist broadcast engineers, Pavel Mikhailov, told me as he configured the tower in Donetsk to show Russian propaganda that July. "Let them understand that Ukraine has no future as a state." There's a map here, a very small map, but it is in white and red. Russian-occupied parts of Ukraine include Luhansk and Donetsk on the far eastern edge, Crimea in the far southeast. Those have been under Russian control since 2014. The rest is white. It's Ukraine, except for those borderlands that fill in the space between Crimea and Donetsk, and then just north of Luhansk. They're striped red and white. When Zelensky took office in 2019, he believed he could win support across eastern Ukraine, even in the regions that had been under Russian control for around 5 years by then. The cities of Donetsk and Luhansk had turned into separatist enclaves, ruled by a caste of Russian-backed warlords and spin doctors who were often assassinated and replaced with new appointees of the Kremlin. One separatist commander known as Batman was sprayed with bullets on a roadside in Luhansk. Another was blown up in a cafe. A third, nicknamed Motorola, was bombed in an apartment building. A fourth was incinerated with a flamethrower. The list went on. While Crimea survived on Russian tourism to its beaches, neither of the two separatist regions in eastern Ukraine had a functioning economy. International sanctions cut them off from any form of legal commerce with the world. Their leaders dealt in contraband, particularly the smuggling of weapons and coal, with some meager subsidies from Russia. No country in the world, not even Russia, recognized their independence, yet they were home to well over 3 million people. Reliable surveys of public opinion were hard to come by in these regions. The best polling available suggested in the fall of 2019, just over half of the people in the separatist parts of eastern Ukraine were not, in fact, separatists at all. They wanted to reintegrate with the rest of the country. Zelensky encouraged them. A native Russian speaker, he had spent most of his early career as a comedian, touring stages and concert halls across Russia and Ukraine. Many people in Crimea and Donbass grew up watching his movies and TV shows. As president, Zelensky promised to start paying pensions to people living under Russian occupation. Soon, new roads opened across the front line, making it easier for people in these regions to visit friends and family in other parts of Ukraine. People should cross over and see that it is better here, and slowly their opinions will change, Zelensky said. We need to bring them back and fight for them. Two photos here in color on these two pages. First, an airstrike on Kyiv's TV tower in March 2022. It's a city. It still looks cold. The trees are bare. Everything looks gray and bare. The sky is blue. There are a couple of what you would consider skyscrapers. Otherwise, three, four, and five-story buildings. And there's a big blob of gray smoke right in the center where a TV tower had been. And then another photo here, again, of a blue sky with a contrail circling a building that may or may not be an airport. I cannot read the writing, since it's either Russian or Ukrainian. Two armed guards in camouflage uniforms stand outside this building. It's Russian troops in southern Ukraine, May 2022. Returning to the text, but within a year of taking office, the president realized his message could not penetrate Russia's monopoly on information in these regions. All major television networks in Ukraine were controlled by private media tycoons. Nearly all of them opposed Zelensky's government, and a few were allied with the Kremlin. In early 2021, Zelensky banned three of the channels that he accused of broadcasting Russian propaganda in Ukraine. The move infuriated Putin, and European leaders criticized Zelensky for encroaching on the freedom of speech, but he saw no other way to curtail Russia's influence over his citizens. "I think these channels killed a lot of people," he told me after banning them. "Not directly," he said, "but through information." February 2022, the start of the full-scale Russian invasion, Zelensky imposed martial law nationwide, which gave the state a powerful weapon in the information war. The airwaves in wartime are treated as critical infrastructure, and the authorities in Ukraine have the right to use them for national defense. Ukraine's biggest television networks quickly agreed to set aside their political agendas and show a unified message of resistance, falling in line behind Zelensky. The result became known as the Telemarathon, a round-the-clock broadcast of news and commentary that airs on all the major channels in Ukraine. Along with the latest updates on the fighting and essential advice on where to shelter, when to evacuate, how to survive, the marathon carries Zelensky's message into every household in the land. Nothing like it has existed in Ukraine since the Soviet era, and critics have complained it smacks of propaganda. A strict new media law, which came into force in March, also earned Zelensky criticism for expanding the state's ability to shut down news outlets. But he insists such measures are essential. "The weapon of information is very important," he said last summer. "It is also important to point this weapon not at one's own head, but in the direction of the enemy." For nearly a year, as Ukraine's armed forces have advanced in a series of counteroffensive, engineers have rushed to bring the telemarathon to liberated towns and cities. The Russians have tried to block it. When they retreated from Kherson in November, Russian forces blew up the city's television tower, which fell in a heap of metal beams and antennas over a city park. The Ukrainians used a transmitter donated by Poland to restore the TV signal in Kherson. 2 days later, the telemarathon showed Zelensky returning the national flag to the center of the city, where hundreds of people had gathered to celebrate their liberation. In other parts of Ukraine, that kind of welcome would be hard to imagine. After living for 9 years on the Russian side of the front, many people in Crimea and the Donbas may not accept Ukraine as their home. The youngest among them have grown up under Russian control, watching the Kremlin's television channels. Thousands of young men in the separatist regions have been conscripted to fight against Ukraine. "They're also dying," Zelensky says, "and when their bodies come home, they're told, 'Look what the Ukrainians have done.' As Ukraine retakes these regions, village by village and town by town, we need to be ready," Zelensky says, "for the fact that some of those people will not be happy to see us." Since last fall, when the military began advancing into Russian-occupied areas, the government in Kyiv has developed plans for reintegrating the people living there. Irina Vereshchuk, who heads ministry in charge of this process, says the government's begun to train teams of civil servants, teachers, and social workers who can sweep into these regions after they're liberated, and as she put it in a recent interview with El País, remake the state from scratch. The government expects many Ukrainians to move into liberated regions and help rebuild them once the Russians are expelled. Under Ukrainian law, anyone who collaborated with the occupiers must face prosecution in a period of transitional justice, which could take years. Ukraine estimates over 600,000 Russians moved into Crimea in the years after its occupation. All of them will need to leave voluntarily or through forced expulsion. Anatoly Stelmach, deputy minister for the reintegration of occupied territories, told the Ukrainian news outlet. Some officials in Kyiv have suggested harsher methods to root out Russian sympathizers. In a TV interview this spring, Kirilo Bunadov, the chief of military intelligence service, said the influence of Russian propaganda has modified the psyches of people in occupied Crimea and eastern Ukraine. We have to re-educate those who can still be re-educated, he said, with the carrot and the stick. Zelensky tends to take a softer line, insisting he can convince people in the occupied regions without the use of force or coercion. The ones who abetted the occupiers must face justice, he says. And under the laws against collaboration Zelensky signed last year, the penalties are stiff, up to 15 years in prison for the worst offenders. As for the rest of the people in these regions, Zelensky wants a chance to speak to them, if not in person, then through television, and to change their minds. We have to try, he told me. We have to get closer, and the closer we get to Donetsk and Luhansk, the higher the chance they might hear us. Here are some of those 100 most influential companies, according to Time magazine. IBM, Quantum Leaders. For decades, nobody gets fired for buying IBM, was an immutable business maxim. The New York behemoth was so dominant, shopping elsewhere was admitting defeat. But IBM's crown slipped as Asian competitors gobbled its lunch. No longer, the $120 billion firm is back at the vanguard of revolutionary technology, running more transformative quantum computers, 60, than the rest of the world combined, while partnering with giants from Boeing to Sony. In just seconds, quantum computers can solve problems that would otherwise take years, from complex calculations about weather patterns to optimizing drug discovery, battery performance, and more. In November, IBM launched the most powerful quantum processing chip ever produced, the 433-qubit Osprey, and in May set its sights even higher, announcing a 10-year plan to make a 100,000-qubit processor. Mattel, big screen Barbie. Mattel, the company behind Barbie, American Girl, and Uno, is rapidly expanding from toys to digital games, merchandise, and films driven by its storied IP. This summer, Mattel will debut Greta Gerwig's much-hyped Barbie movie, the iconic doll's first on the big screen in her 64-year history. Barbie is just the first of 14 projects in development from Mattel's new films division, ranging from a Hot Wheels movie with J.J. Abrams to a Barney film with Daniel Kaluuya. Led by CEO Enon Greitz, Mattel also won back the lucrative Disney Princess contract from rival Hasbro, launching new dolls this year, and has broken ground on a theme park in Arizona. That was by Eliana Doctorman. John Deere, high-tech tractors. The iconic 186-year-old manufacturer still makes green tractors, but now loaded with digital tech that aims to bolster farmer productivity. Last year, Deere debuted See and Spray Ultimate, that's S-E-E and Spray Ultimate, which uses computer vision and machine learning to detect and spray only weeds, not crops, and its first fully autonomous tractor, which can be remotely managed via an app. 500,000 machines worldwide are now connected. John Deere aims for 1.5 million by 2026 with a bespoke satellite service on the horizon. We are looking to move the farmer away from broad decisions for an entire field to plant-level management, opening up a new level of visibility and precision on the farm, says CTO Jami Hindman. All right, I'm going to try to read this little column to you. It's very, very poorly printed. It's kind of like a blurry white on blurry blue. CVS Health, healthcare giant. This is by Jamie Ducharme. Healthcare is broken, says CVS Health's chief medical officer, Dr. Sri Shagatura, and his company wants to put it back together again. Over the past year, the drugstore chain, led by CEO Karen Lynch, has dropped close to $20 billion on acquisitions of Oak Street Health, a senior-focused primary care network, and Signify Health, a home health care provider. Between those deals, its 2018 acquisition of health insurer Aetna, and the continued expansion of the Minute Clinic walk-in care brand, which now operates in more than 1,100 locations nationwide, CVS has cemented its role as a player in nearly every aspect of U.S. health care. Now, here's another blurry one I'm going to try to read. This is in blurry white over blurry green. Lockheed Martin, ramping up production, by Guadalupe Gonzalez. Two weapons have proved particularly crucial in Ukraine's fight against Russia, both made by the largest U.S. defense contractor, which has upped production to fill new orders. High-mobility artillery rocket system vehicles can fire rockets to hit targets nearly 50 miles away. And the shoulder-mounted anti-tank javelin system, jointly produced with Raytheon, allows troops to quickly take cover after firing a guided missile. The U.S. has provided more than 10,000 of the latter to Ukraine as of May 21. Our products have proven to be effective for Ukrainian forces courageously defending their nation, says COO Frank St. John. The company's stock has benefited too, rising more than 25% from January 2022 to June 2023. Major League Baseball, Need for Speed, by Sean Gregory. Baseball has always been obsessed with numbers, home runs, strikeouts, runs batted in. Major League Baseball's 2023 success can be summed up in three digits, 2:39, as in 2 hours, 39 minutes, the average time of a game this season compared with 3 hours, 6 minutes a season ago. In recent years, baseball, whose overall annual revenue approached $11 billion in 2022, has faced a slew of criticism for taking too long. So this year, MLB instituted a pitch clock, 15 seconds to hurl with the bases empty, 20 seconds with a runner on to quicken the pace. The rule, so far, has worked. MLB Commissioner Rob Manfred expects attendance to rise by up to 500,000 from pre-pandemic levels. SK Group battery build-out. South Korea's second-largest conglomerate is making big bets on American-made EV batteries. SK's partnerships with automakers to build new battery factories, fueled by federal clean vehicle credits that encourage domestic production, will help reduce U.S. reliance on China and create a southern battery belt. In April, SK, like Susan Karen, announced plans with Hyundai for a $5 billion plant in Georgia. A joint venture with Ford, now underway, involves two massive battery facilities together worth $11.4 billion, including one in Kentucky that will be the country's largest. The U.S. is showing what can happen when the right conditions converge to support EV growth, says Chairman Che Taiwan. Disney Corporate Citizen by Belinda Luscombe. Future historians looking for a crisp illustration of the cultural divisions in 2020's America will find it hard to resist this one, a 100-year-old company built on family fun in a political showdown with a conservative governor looking to make his name. That showdown intensified in May when Disney canceled a $1 billion development project in Orlando as part of its feud with Governor Ron DeSantis. Companies that endure, says Bob Iger, who unexpectedly returned as CEO in November, do not abandon core values, and Disney remains formidable. In 2022, its film studio was the world's top grossing for a seventh straight year. Siemens, S-I-E-M-E-N-S, Digitizing Factories by Jared Lindzon. At age 175, industrial technology powerhouse Siemens has its sights on the metaverse, its X-Celerator platform, and that is X-Celerator platform, launched last year, includes digital twin software to create photorealistic virtual versions of real-world manufacturing facilities. Companies are using X-Celerator to speed up production of electric vehicles, improve battery cell manufacturing, reduce factory carbon footprints. Siemens also has a multi-year contract with the U.S. FDA to help medical device companies speed product development and increase manufacturing capacity using digital twin techniques. The industrial metaverse, says CEO Roland Busch, has the potential to solve many real-world problems. Samsung, another blurry turquoise over white. Smartphone trendsetter by Guadalupe Gonzalez. Samsung and Apple are duking it out for first place in the global smartphone market. And the Korean conglomerate took the top spot in early 2023. When it comes to foldables, Samsung has become a dominant force. Apple's playing catch-up with rumors its first foldable is set for 2024 or 2025, as Samsung releases 5th-gen Galaxy Z Fold and Galaxy Z Flip models this year. Samsung even partners with companies to allow, for example, YouTube videos to continue playing as a screen unfolds, or two Microsoft 365 apps to run side-by-side in split-screen mode. Beyond foldables, Samsung's Galaxy S23 Ultra, released in February, pushes the camera phone bar higher. Moving now into Time Off, Back for One Last Adventure by Stephanie Zakarik. The final installment of the Indiana Jones franchise may be lackluster, but Harrison Ford imbues it with heart. A photo here on this page, all in brown and sepia and gray tones, of Harrison Ford in his Indiana Jones uniform, looking very old Indiana Jones-ish. Again, Stephanie Zakarik writes this review. Harrison Ford is known to flummox journalists by being less than forthcoming in interviews. In public appearances, he tends to radiate an "I don't really want to be here" vibe, which is why it meant something to see him take the stage just ahead of the con premiere of Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny, May 18. With tiny glimmers of almost tears in his eyes, con head Terry Frémaux had introduced Ford by showing a highlight reel of his long prismatic career, from American Graffiti to The Mosquito Coast to Blade Runner and beyond. It must be strange to sit there in a tux and watch your various incarnations across decades flash past you on a screen. It is probably true when you're a movie star, others are more attuned to the natural changes in your face than you are. No wonder Ford, now 80, seemed moved by the tribute. "You know, I love you too," he said to the audience after the applause had waned. "You give my life purpose and meaning, and I'm grateful for that." Ford is pretty much the best thing about James Mangold's Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny, the fifth film in the franchise. The first, Steven Spielberg's 1981 Raiders of the Lost Ark, was inspired by adventure serials of the 1930s and 40s. The idea had been conceived by George Lucas and Philip Kaufman, with Spielberg joining later. In 1981, looking back at movies from 50 years earlier felt like gazing through the wrong end of the telescope. The first movie's lo-fi, high-fun touches its fixation on ancient golden gewgaws, slithery snakes, and cartoon bad guys seemed so mistily far away from what the movies had become by that time. Now, in 2023, when filmmakers have tons of new technology at their disposal, it is easier than ever to make stuff look old-timey. This new installment is set mostly in 1969, around the time of the lunar landing. By this point, any Indiana Jones picture is going to have almost too many layers of meta-nostalgia to sift through. It's more likely to foster fond memories of your old, busted childhood VCR than it is to conjure Buck Rogers or Zorro's Fighting Legion. That is not a good thing or a bad thing, it is merely a thing, but it does make you think about how readily your own cherished vision of the past can be used as a marketing tool, and how increasingly, and for some good reasons, we yearn to be returned to olden times that are not really even that old. Yet, Dial of Destiny creaks under the weight of the franchise's stature. The movie's opening flashback scenes give us a much younger Indiana Jones, in the form of a digitally de-aged Harrison Ford. He looks reasonably realistic. There's nothing too terribly Hall of Presidents about him, but the effect is disconcerting even so, especially following the tribute reel the audience at the con premiere had just seen, where the younger Ford had been brought to life before our eyes with no digital gimmickry. That is part of the wonder of movies. You can always go back to look at the Bette Davis of the 1930s and 1940s, the Montgomery Clift of the 1950s, and see the beauty of youth played back for you even long after a star is gone. The de-aging technique used in Dial of Destiny scanned reams of footage from every Lucasfilm movie in which Ford had ever appeared, as well as outtakes to pick up various angles of his younger face in every possible permutation of lighting. Such an efficient tool. But efficiency is not the same as magic. In the de-aged portion of Dial of Destiny, we catch up with Indiana as World War II winds down. Hitler's retreated to his bunker. The end seems near. A bunch of Nazi heavies see what's coming and try to skate off with some looted art and artifacts. And the youngified anthropologist Indy needs to stop them. It's here we meet the story's marvelously villainous villain, Mads Mikkelsen's Jürgen Fohler, an adorably nerdy physicist in Clark Kent glasses. Too bad he's a Nazi. In this early part of the film, we also meet Indiana's pal, Basil Shaw, Toby Jones, an academic whose eyes gleam at the mere mention of the story's object of desire, the dial thingy of the title, an important-looking doodly-doo invented by Archimedes that can locate fissures in time. Everybody wants it, most of all Fohler. We watch in something that's supposed to approximate awe, but doesn't quite, as Indiana and Toby face off against Fohler and various other Nazi thugs atop a train speeding through the European countryside. It is as thrilling as any clatteringly fake CGI heavy scene can be. It's also a harbinger of what's to come. There are so many chase sequences in Dial of Destiny. The movie seems held together with slender bits of plot rather than the other way around. Worse yet, they're so heavily CGI'd, they come off as grimly dutiful rather than delightful. About a half hour of Nazi-era setup, we finally get to meet Indiana Jones of the late 1960s, who looks as Harrison Ford actually does now. Phew! Indy's winding down his tenure at Hunter College, where he's been a revered archaeology professor. But he's drawn out of retirement when Basil Shaw's grown daughter, Helena Phoebe Waller-Bridge, now a brainy archaeologist type herself, first charms him as a means of procuring the dial of whatever, and then runs off with it. Then the slippery Fohler shows up. He wants it too, now more than ever. It is important to note, though, that the object in question is only half the dial. You've got to have something to look for in an Indiana Jones movie. As Helena Waller-Bridge, with her Tommy Toon-like legs and daffily expressive eyes, is one of the movie's better natural effects. But even she gets lost in the overly complex plot, which involves travel from New York to Tangiers to Athens to Sicily that should be exciting but isn't, aside from the old-style cartoon maps used to trace the adventurer's perambulations, which are adorable. And then there are the interminable chase scenes. In New York, on the run from somebody or other during an Apollo 11 parade, Indy rides a horse right into the 59th Street station and onto the tracks, directly in the path of a speeding subway train. We see how he gets out of this one, sort of. But the narrow escape does not make visual sense. It's a case of a filmmaker signaling something's truly madly astonishing, but failing to deliver the actual goods. The movie's best scenes are the more modest ones that remind us what we loved about the earlier movies. The way, for example, a host of creepy crawlies come clattering down the walls of a cave, inquisitive and menacing at once, but there's also a murky underwater sequence, and one of the movie's worst sins, a tragically underused Antonio Banderas as ace undersea diver Rinaldo. The best thing about Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny is its ending. A reunion of characters that anybody who has any affection for the franchise is probably longing to see. And it is here that Ford, with his current-day face, marked by all the actual living that goes into a life, is at his best, showing the kind of gruff, reluctant tenderness that's become one of his trademarks. He's already got the best face. Neither money nor technology can buy. Here are a few more companies from the 100 best companies according to Time. TikTok, T-I-K-T-O-K, commanding attention. TikTok has over 150 million users in the U.S. alone, but it is the company's ownership structure that garners much of the attention it receives today. The short video app, which helped launch the careers of chart-topping artists from Lil Nas X to Doja Cat, is owned by Beijing-based ByteDance, B-Y-T-E-D-A-N-C-E, prompting privacy and national security concerns over alleged data transfers to the Chinese state. Over a dozen governments, including those of the UK, the US, and Australia, have banned the app on official devices, seeking to allay the concerns of a US congressional panel in March. CEO Xu Zichu said TikTok employs 40,000 moderators to track harmful content and is leading a $1.5 billion project to create a new U.S. subsidiary specifically to safeguard American user data. We will keep TikTok free from any manipulation by any government, Chu said. That article by Charlie Campbell. Kickstarter Inside Out Impact by Novid Parsi. In 2022, the online crowdfunding platform saw its biggest campaign ever. Nearly $42 million for a sci-fi author's self-publishing effort. But recent changes inside Kickstarter are just as notable. Workers at the company unionized and shaved a day off its work week, setting a powerful example of workers' rights in tech. We have been just as productive or even more productive with a four-day work week, says Everett Taylor, who in September became the company's first black CEO. Kickstarter's senior leadership is now 75% women and 63% people of color, and it donates 2.5% of its after-tax profit to organizations fighting inequality. The focus is on maximizing Kickstarter's real-world impact rather than revenue, Taylor says. Apple shortening the supply chain. By Don Steinberg. Under pressure to reduce its reliance on Chinese factories for economic and human rights reasons, the $394 billion company is pulling its supply chain closer to home in ways that could boost the U.S. economy. In May, it announced a multi-billion dollar deal with semiconductor producer Broadcom for radio frequency chips and other wireless components that will be made at facilities in Colorado and elsewhere domestically. It is part of Apple's plan to invest $430 billion in the U.S. over 5 years, likely with generous aid from the Federal CHIPS Act. All of Apple's products depend on technology engineered and built here in the United States, CEO Tim Cook said in a press release, touting the ingenuity of U.S. manufacturing. Live Nation Entertainment, Taking the Stage, by Mariah Espada. Chaotic ticketing for Taylor Swift's Blockbuster Eras tour was a reminder of Live Nation Entertainment's power over in-person events. The Ticketmaster parent company, which says it advocates for artist control of ticket resales, is the global leader for live shows, operating and promoting more than 40,000 a year and over 100 festivals. Despite the controversy, first quarter 2023 revenue surged 73% from the previous year to $3.1 billion, and a record 19 million fans came out IRL, a remarkable recovery from the pandemic pause. Even facing a federal investigation into its position and practices, Live Nation continues to sell more tickets than anyone else in the world. CATL by Alejandro de la Garza. This is Battery Behemoth, based in Fujian, China, Contemporary Amperex Technology Company Limited, CATL, is the world's largest EV battery maker and the one to beat in battery tech. This spring, it started mass producing the new QILIN Quelun battery, which can extend EV range to 600 miles on a single charge. U.S. EVs average about 300 miles. In April, it unveiled new technology for a semi-solid-state lithium battery it says will store nearly twice as much energy as the best ones on the market today, further expanding EV range and bringing electric passenger planes closer. Most groundbreaking innovations come with caveats that commercial development is years off, but CATL says this one will be in production in 6 months. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.